From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Jonathan Deal. Jim Groom is the director of the Division of Teaching and Learning Technologies and adjunct professor at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. A prolific blogger, Jim's blog, Bava Tuesdays, covers a wide assortment of content from personal musings to the intersection of technology and education. Welcome, Jim, to Writer's Talk.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here.
Please.
So tell me, what got you interested with this whole intersection of technology and education in the first place?
That's a good question. It's funny enough, I started out as what they'll call a blog father.
What is a blog father?
I started blogging about my kid in 2004. Oh. So 2004, actually a little bit earlier, 2002, a friend of mine started their own co-op web hosting, which basically said, $2, you can get your own web hosting account. And so I played around with it. I made stupid websites with Smurfs on it and kind of got ready for my kid to be born. And I got ready for a while because it took 2 years. But 2004, when my first son was born, I started kind of creating websites, kind of documenting it, because half of his family is from Italy. So my wife's from Italy. So it was an easy way to share all that data. I also was a graduate student and a PhD candidate in English Lit, and I used stuff like Blackboard to some degree and taught online. So when I was doing this, I've discovered this program called WordPress. And WordPress is an easy application. People know it now. It's kind of like a household name, but then it was just brand new. It came out in 2004. Right. So I used it to create a blog for my son to share all the stupid videos and stuff I created as a kind of doting parent. But then I realized, man, it's so easy to create a dynamic website with this application, and I don't have to program HTML, and it's cheap. Why can't we do this in universities? And so I kind of went down the path of technology and education as an English graduate student who had a kid who got into the blogosphere kind of. And it's been a way for me to exercise the kind of creativity that has kind of informed a lot of the work that I've done since. So it's been a really kind of fun space. And I never knew when I was doing my PhD, because that's such a grueling process, that something as silly as blogging would liberate me and kind of push me into a space where I felt comfortable writing. I had a lot of fun doing it. And I was kind of getting a different form of literacy on the web with stuff like memes, video, audio, just having a blast. You know, I never knew writing could be so much fun.
So one thing that I found obviously about you when I was researching you was that you coined this term edupunk.
Edupunk.
Right. Did I say that right? Edupunk?
You did.
Okay, good.
It's all caps, too.
Oh, really? It's all caps. Okay. Well, edupunk's in all caps. What exactly does that mean, and what does an edupunk look like?
Good point. Yeah. There is a very particular look, and it's funny. It's 5 years ago almost now. It'll be 5 years ago in May that I coined edupunk. And, you know, edupunk was basically a rant about systems like Blackboard or learning management systems that had kind of taken over our whole way of doing business. Universities kind of abdicated any kind of control and creative control over where people teach and learn online. And I found that really problematic. I was building these WordPress kind of multi-sites by that point, which allowed thousands of people to get on and own and control their own space, kind of like a WordPress.com or a Blogger. And it was so much more liberating and freeing. And there are some things you need to do with the LMS, but so many schools had kind of basically said, we're just going to let online learning happen in the LMS. We're not going to try and do any innovation in that space. And it really started to kind of depress me. So edupunk was an alternative, I thought of it, at least at the time, where people would actually build, DIY, make these spaces. The web was full of these easy, free, open source tools that people could use. Why aren't we kind of focusing on that? So it was basically a call to arms for people to kind of get out of these corporate-driven systems and, you know, take control of the web, bring it back to them, and kind of start framing their own identity around these spaces that they inhabit. And that's all it was. It could have been a stupid post that I wrote and no one cared about, but for some reason it hit a nerve. And bam, it blew up. I started to believe in it, which was the danger of it. So for a couple of years, I had to go through rehab to get over the idea, because it was just an idea. I mean, it wasn't an ideology. It wasn't a look. It wasn't a feel. There's no one thing that makes an edupunk. I mean, it's just basically thinking about what DIY culture has kind of really become in the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. The idea of people kind of really taking some ownership and having some deep affection for the spaces where they not only teach and learn, but where they live online. Because more and more we occupy that space as citizens. And so it's important that all of our the work we do and create isn't controlled by these third parties.
And you brought this do-it-yourself attitude to the class that you teach,
yes.
Right, at Mary Washington University.
That's right.
DS-106.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about DS-106?
You know, Edupunk, I got a lot of pushback. A lot of people push back on the idea that, oh, you're kind of framing the whole punk rock thing, that you're holier than now. And I really wasn't. I hadn't even thought about the punk rock thing. You know, I was kind of a half-ass punk in the 80s, you know, I listened to the hardcore punk and stuff, but it's not like I was like identifying that punk rock. But people got pissed about it. Some people got excited about it, but some people called me out over it. And I was like, really? It's just a stupid term. DS-106 was beautiful because it was a digital storytelling class that started out as a computer science class that teaches digital storytelling. But it started to kind of get a cult following because we didn't do the traditional digital storytelling like, you fell off your bike, you scraped your knee, you know, and then your favorite song's behind it, and there's your 6-minute video, and it's got to be 6 minutes, and it's got to have the Ken Burns effect, and that's digital storytelling. And it's like, no, it's not digital storytelling. Digital storytelling is us putting out life bits of us on all these different social networks on a regular basis. And how we think about that narrative we're constantly creating and owning is what this class should be about. So I made all the students get their own web hosts and domains, build their own spaces, and tell their stories and narrate them for anyone who will listen. And it was out on the open web. And they had a blast with it. We started creating all these different kind of assignments. But I only had like, I'm like a traditional professor. I had like 9 assignments. These are the 9 general assignments you will take. And they
each of these are graded, exactly. And you have to finish these.
And they're mine because they're good,
right? That's right.
And so one of my friends, Tom Woodward, said to me, you know, your assignments are right, but they're not that good. And so I went home and I cried, right? I was like, ooh. But once I got over myself a little bit, I realized that, you know, he's right. So I work with another person I work with, Martha Burtis, who's amazing, said, you know what? We can build an assignment repository that lets students basically create the assignments. They don't like the ones we have. They create their own. And they did. And people from all over the world started doing these students' assignments. Hmm. And we opened up the class in 2011, and like 500 to 1,000 people signed up and started doing assignments and having fun, and it kind of became a community. Hmm. And for me, that's what Edupunk was all about, was a creative community doing things and controlling their own spaces on the web. And DS-106 was awesome because it was just a number and 2 letters. It didn't have any political meaning. Like, when you think of DS-106, you don't think of, like, punk rock or, right. You know, Doc Martens. You're just like, what the hell is DS-106? And I like that. So Edupunk kind of morphed into something that I think was a little bit more tangible. It was a community of students and people on the open web creating and sharing stuff. Animated GIFs, memes, audio assignments, video assignments, you name it. But the bottom line was that they narrate how they do their work, where they do it, and they own it. And that sense of ownership, you know, it doesn't mean the same thing to everyone, but I think it's important for people to own the stuff they create. And even if at the end of the day they decide to delete it, great. That's an informed decision they're making about their work on the web, which is much better than putting in an LMS and hiding it from the world or putting it on some third-party site that eventually goes away. So I'm kind of very interested in students not telling them what to do, but like having a conversation about what it means to live on the web and what it means for them to kind of inhabit that space. And that's really what DS-106 is about. And I think everything you do, when you change a status on Facebook, you're telling a story.
Right.
And I think that obviously that's very granular, but the web is granular storytelling right now. Things like Twitter, Facebook. Right. I mean, we're telling stories in microseconds. And I'm fascinated by what that's going to mean at the end of our lives. You know, like, how will my kids see my story? Hmm. And I'm fascinated by that because they're essential to it. And I want to make sure I can archive that and present it to them and to their kids, hopefully, in 100 years. So how would you archive your Facebook? How would you archive your Twitter? How would you archive all your images? Right. What the hell is Instagram? Like, all those questions are huge.
Right.
And I don't think universities are dealing with them. I think they're basically either finding this kind of siloed space, put your stuff here, just don't do something stupid. It's just this fear. And I'm like, no, man, this is the space. 60,000 students, awesome, Ohio State. You engage that and you kind of push that out, what you have is a movement. You know, and I just love that idea that if a university would get behind what the students are doing in this space and acknowledge it and you know, integrate it into their teaching and learning, you know, you have a whole new kind of digital citizen emerging. That's important.
You're listening to Writers Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with guest interviewer OSU student Jonathan Deal and our guest, Jim Groom.
What would that look like if, say, like Ohio State were to do something like that? What do you think something that would look like on campus?
I don't know. I don't think it would look, you know, I think the way I think about it, what happened at UMW, where I'm from, University of Mary Washington, is it happened very organically. So what would happen if I didn't tell you where you did your writing or where you did your teaching or your classes, but I gave you a space, your domain, right? And you basically would do your work for a class, and then you'd have a tag, and you'd tag a work you did, say, for your biology 101 class, a lab. And it would automatically syndicate to that class site. And you would decide whether it's personal, whether it's private, who can see it. And you would decide if it's public. And you would have control over that, but it would live in your own archive. And so by the end of your 4 years at OSU, you had a great time. You had not only your schoolwork there, but you had your personal stuff there because you want to own those images. All those parties you were at, you took pictures at, you also own them, control who could see them. But creating a space whereby you still do the stuff you do, but you have some control over it, and we build what is called the syndication bus to decide where it goes and how. It's basically what Facebook does. But Facebook puts it within a huge silo, so they control it. I'm thinking, why don't universities think about how a system like this would allow us not only to, you had an awesome paper on, you know, writing, for example, and podcasts. And so you wrote it, and University Department of Writing picked it up. Why couldn't they ask for you to just ping it to them, send it to them, and then put it on their website seamlessly? And you would have control of it, but you would decide where it goes and how. And we're so close to this kind of infrastructure being real. And OSU kind of helps you frame the think about what it means to manage and control that space and how you would do stuff within it. And how you would use that space to push out the things like Facebook, Twitter. You wouldn't give them up because that's where people meet. That's the social. What I'm interested in is some control and some ideas of kind of archiving for the future. And so that's what it to me would look like. It wouldn't get rid of the social networks that we're on now. It would actually allow us another layer where we control it. But then the other thing is we could have a whole nother social network built around the academic. The work you do that one or two people see, maybe now 200,000 people could see. And I love that idea. And I love the idea of pushing students' work and promoting it. Because I don't want to come to a website and see a brochure. Mm-hmm. I want to come to a website and I want to see you. And I want to see what you did, and I want to see why I should be basically excited about coming to OSU. I just think universities still need to be a space of experimentation and open sharing. You know, we need to open and share the work we do.
You're listening to Writers Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with guest interviewer OSU student Jonathan Deal and our guest, Jim Groom.
This whole openness brings me to this big buzzword that I know is a hot topic in your blogs and on your on your Twitter feed, which are MOOCs.
That's right.
Which stand for Massively Online Open Courses, right?
That's right. Yeah, good.
And I know that, I think I know what you're going to say with this one, but how is your course, how is DS-106 different than a MOOC? Or is it a MOOC and or are we defining MOOCs correctly?
So Massive Open Online Courses, they started back in 2007, 2008, particularly George Siemens and Stephen Downes framed this experience in amazing ways. And they basically said, we'll open up our course to whoever wants to take it. We will not necessarily respond on everyone's work. We'll let communities emerge around that. And that was the idea, kind of crowdsourcing this kind of, you know, communal effort. And they had 2,500 people sign up, which was amazing back then, right? It's nothing now, but back then it was amazing. And they basically ran with this idea. And the thing that always struck me about MOOCs was, you know, the scale was fascinating. And I think Siemens and Downes were very interested in that scale. And I think it's important. Now, that massive was crucial. But if you take the M away, you have this open online course, which I think is more akin to what DS-106 is. It's not massive. I mean, a massive course of 500 to 1,000 people, that's an everyday occurrence at OSU. No one look at me and say, oh, that's a massive course. There are people who do that here. So I don't know if it's massive as much as it's what Alan Levine said, and I like this idea. It's kind of fractal. The idea is that the community itself gives a pawn to other people, and that moves out. It's not monolithic. What I never liked about MOOCs was just how monolithic the experience was. It's like there's 80,000 people in one course, in one LMS, and you'll put all your information there, and you'll learn through video. It's like, well, that's YouTube. Like, that's nothing new. It's not exciting. It's the LMS rehashed. And the MOOC idea is very powerful, and I don't want to discount that. And it's really done amazing things for ed tech or educational technology. It's introduced a whole different layer of discussion about online learning. And for that, I can't discount the MOOC at all. And I don't want to discount the people who really pioneered it. But the way in which elite universities have jumped onto it and have kind of said this is what's going to save us. I mean, let's be clear. Let's call, you know, let's call it what it is. It's branding. You have this ability to brand your university with hundreds of thousands of people through a corporate space that's providing you the hosting. And it's not that different. The difference between Blackboard and, you know, Coursera is that Coursera is claiming to be open. And so people can actually see it, which is Blackboard. People got it so they couldn't see it or desire to learn or whatever. The trick is it open? I mean, is it truly open? Do you have control? Can you reuse the work that's in there? Do students, do they own any of the work they do in there? Can they syndicate it out? Do they have that kind of domain? And I don't want to say like DS-106 is different from MOOCs because like branding it like through difference. I don't like care who uses DS-106. I just don't think that outsourcing your expertise as universities, as is happening right now, to a corporation like Coursera, a venture capital driven corporation, is a good model for universities. What I would like to see is they get involved with a MOOC provider like edX, which has open source platform that a school like OSU could install and run, or that OSU does some of the kind of, you know, innovative work around building a platform, or even framing a syndication hub, or just thinking, yes, this is an important thing, moment of online learning. It's not going away. The MOOCs have kind of ushered in that moment.
And so this future then that you would like to see, this, you know, your course is almost then an OOC, an online open course, this OOC-like future that you see, what would that look like for the faculty members or for the students? I mean, we have this participatory, what'd you call it? The participatory space where students can create their own content and they could be syndicated across these different channels. But what would that look like for a professor, or what would that look like for a faculty member?
It's a big shift. I mean, I was in graduate school in the 90s and into the 2000s. And, you know, this stuff was just starting to hit kind of then. And I'm kind of one of those people, I'm not really a tech savvy guy. I just kind of was in the right time, and I'm kind of like a salesman. I could talk, da 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 da. But like, I got into it. I got excited about it. I got excited about its possibilities. And I think there's a number of faculty who are. And this kind of digital divide language of, and not, I'm talking about the poor versus rich, I'm talking about the millennials versus the people who have been in it, is really divisive, because it basically says there are those people who understand just naturally. They were born with the computer in their hand, like you, right? Like, people would look at you and be like, you.
Surely you know how to use this piece of technology. You're young.
That's right. And it's an abdication, both on the part of the students who want to be, you know, I think, you know, some really do know a ton, but most, like most people, need to learn about it. And so I don't want to abdicate that, and professors shouldn't abdicate that. So we're doing a program at UMW right now where 30 faculty who signed up are actually getting their own domain space, and they're building their own spaces there, and they're figuring out how this works as a space for them to understand their own kind of, you know, online presence, but also as a space where, you know, they can maybe start building and managing their own classes and like understand what it means to network a class online. So we have another thing called the Online Learning Initiative, where we're trying to cultivate the basic values of a liberal arts education, you know, interaction, right? very close kind of knitted community and say, you know, that's not impossible to do it online. How do we do it? And it's not going to scale the way a MOOC scales, because MOOCs aren't about that. MOOCs are about saving a certain amount of money and experimenting with the question of scale, which are important. But we have a very different vision. No one's ever going to come to UMW like they would to OSU and say, run a MOOC because you have a superstar professor. We're a very different entity. And so we have to approach it in very different ways. And I think we're trying to figure out at what point can a faculty member come to a class and still feel engaged with their students and still feel like what they do online is, you know, not necessarily the same as or replicated what happens in the face-to-face, because it's going to be different, but they still feel their space is central to the teaching and learning. And I think it is. I mean, I don't think it changes. Being part of DS-106, being part of that, I had to give up some of my ideas about what the greatest assignments are. But my role as, you know, mentor, as, you know, a space for faculty students to come and to get information, to get feedback, was crucial. And they didn't understand how to make an anime GIF when they came in. They didn't understand what good video editing looked like, what good audio editing looked like. These are things they were expecting me to help with, and it was still my job. And I don't think that's going to go away if you're teaching writing online or you're teaching chemistry online. It's going to be there. Are there more resources online for people to get to reinforce what they're doing? Yes. But the connection between people, between a faculty member and a student, is still essential, I think. I mean, the relationships that make education what it is don't go away because we found some way to scale it like Walmart. You know what I mean? Like, you still need people at the heart of it.
Right.
And I'm afraid to scale education like Walmart. Like, I'm afraid what that means. I mean, these what we're selling is students as universities. You're selling good students. So what are we going to do? You know, are MOOCs selling the cheapest students? Are they selling the students who've had the least interaction with professionals in their space? Like, what's the advantage for students? You know, and as a student, I would ask you, would you want to take a completely online course where you never had interaction with a professor, you know, your whole career? What might that mean for you? I mean, maybe some would. And we talked about it before we even started. There's reasons why online education is exploding. Flexibility, right. Ability not to move in certain ways. I mean, online learning's here. I just hope we do it right.
You're listening to Writers Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with guest interviewer OSU student Jonathan Deal, and our guest, Jim Groom.
I like how you brought the point back to the fact that this whole online experience, this whole thing with education, it all goes back to fundamentals once again. It's about doing what we do best and using the technology to simply enhance it.
Absolutely.
As opposed to try to completely... the reimagination of it is just a reverting back to fundamentals.
Yeah. And I mean, you said it beautifully. Doug Engelbart, who invented the mouse, amongst many other things, right? He's a pioneer of the 60s. And Gardner Campbell, who's a mentor of mine, talks extensively about him. But particularly, you know, augmenting the way that right. Doug Engelbart talked about computers, not as replacing, not as this kind of purely like we're going to take the computer and replace you with a laptop, but that it was going to augment you. Like, it was going to augment the experience.
Right. And hopefully enhance the experience and make things
Absolutely.
Easier.
Yeah. And bring you in contact with potentially thousands of people that before that internet came around, it was impossible.
Right.
And I think we're in a stage right now where we're transitioning and we're maybe in some ways missing the idea of that. Like, it's not like you're saying we're replacing education with MOOCs. No, we're experiencing a completely new level of scale and of augmentation. But there are still some fundamentals
right.
around relationships and people.
And with that experimentation, there's a lot of fear associated with
yeah.
it. You know, there's a lot of fear associated with faculty members feeling that they may become obsolete
yeah.
with these you know, massive courses where they no longer will get that student interaction. They'll be replaced by some professor 500 miles away who's teaching
Yeah,
all those thousands of students who may be their students.
And let's be clear. I mean, there's reasons. Those fears are grounded. I mean, the way adjunct labor has increased across the university kind of setting, I mean, there are reasons to see why they're cutting full-time positions. And I mean, there's reasons to be concerned. what I'm trying to do, because when I talk about MOOCs, and even when you brought them up, I was a little bit like, I can feel my back, you know, my hair on my back going up like a cat, only because I don't want to be curmudgeonly. Like, I don't want to be like, no, MOOCs. I want to understand that this is a really, like you said, it's a rapidly transforming environment right now. And I don't want to be an angry person. I don't want to be someone who just gets mad when someone mentions something. But I do want us as a community, as a culture, to come around, like, what are those fundamentals? And what is the limit of the MOOCs? What's its power and what's its limit? Because if you're in the field I'm in right now, educational technology, you get a little bit beaten down by the term because it's everywhere. It would be great if we could have that conversation about the fundamentals and think about what it is that brings, you know, students to a university like Ohio State University. What are they looking for? I mean, there's the experience in the classroom, but there's also the experience of the frats, of the parties, of the football games. Like, there's an entire community that's happening here, and that you have alumni coming back who are giving money, who love this place because of it. And part of it's academic, but part of it is a whole bunch of intangibles that if we were to basically run the university experience into this, you know, streamlined box store idea of get your degree in 4 years for $6.99 or less, we would miss something. Now, on the other hand, public funding for universities put a lot more debt on students. I mean, students are carrying around a ton of debt. And we as a culture have to deal with that too. And so I can understand why people would say MOOCs save us money. MOOCs are good for the debt problem. Yeah, but at the expense of an experience that's crucial to forming minds? I don't know. I mean, we haven't put a price tag on that. And I am not suggesting students go into insane debt for it. But we need to find some middle ground where we're able to kind of think through that process, you know, rather than throwing technology at it as a solution rather than an augmentation.
And that's one thing that I appreciated a lot about your blog and about your Twitter feed, was that you weren't afraid to try to address this issue and to just talk about it openly.
Yeah.
I forget who said it, that you shouldn't just talk about the problems, you should offer a solution to the problems. And I really appreciated the fact that you, in your all your writings, or at least many of your writings.
Yeah, exactly.
Try to imagine what those solutions could be. And like you said, it is an experimentation. And a lot of those things are probably going to get thrown out, you know, and won't be right. But that's part of the experimentation process. And I think it's awesome that your university is standing behind you
and is giving
you the freedom to fail at it.
They've been great.
So if it fails, well, it failed. We tried. Let's try something else.
That's right. And I know, like, there are universities, you know, where that happens. And people say, well, you're a 4,000 student university, you can do that. But this is happening at Penn State University. They're doing stuff on this kind of scale, and they have, what, 90,000? So
it can happen anywhere.
It can happen anywhere. I mean, and I think you're right. If you have support at the administrative level and you have great students, which I find there's great students everywhere.
I don't need to go far,
you know, and you have great students who get excited by it, it doesn't take much. And, you know, when you fail, it's usually a lot more, you learn a lot more as a result. And we've had tremendous amounts of failures, and nothing that's ever stopped what we've done. But, you know, if I could count the number of failures, they'd be far greater than the two successes you might have mentioned, like, you know, DS-106 or EduPunk, which I don't know if it was a success. But, you know, there's a lot more. There's a much longer list of all the things we tried that blew up on us. And I just think... I'm still like a kid in a candy shop when I get on the internet. And I just think when I'm on the web, I'm just like, wow. Like, this is an amazing thing that so many people are willing to openly share. So much stuff they know. It's like the biggest classroom in the world. And why would we need MOOCs to reinforce that? This is already happening at universities. You use web on a daily basis as part of your classes. Your faculty use the web. It's not like they're thinking the web's going to replace what they do. They're amazing curators for that experience. They have experience that you don't, that they can introduce you to and get you your fire lit. And, you know, that's it. Like, you know, how do we create platforms that unlock passion? Like, that's not what anyone's talking about, but that's it, you know?
Right.
So,
right. Yeah. That's awesome. Jim? Thank you very much for meeting with me here.
Thank you.
And for Writer's Talk, I'm Jonathan Deal.
You've been listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. For more from our guest, Jim Groom, visit www.writerstalk.org. Thanks today to our guest host, OSU student Jonathan Deal. Until next time, this is Doug Dangler. Keep writing.